come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One gang could run this city. One gang. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
Hey everybody, this week on the podcast, this one ranks up there very high for me. Terry Gilliam of Monty Python. I cannot believe I'm saying that. We talk about his days as a member of Monty Python, how that came about, his days as an animator as a young guy, how he fled the U.S. in the 60s because he was fed up with everything going on in this country, how he became, he renounced his citizenship in 2006, and his life as a director, directing such films as The Holy Grail, Baron von Munchausen, 12 Monkeys, his new movie, The Zero Theorem with Christoph Waltz, really cool movie, is out right now. You are going to love this interview. I'm really excited about it. We talk about a whole host of things, and he's a really fascinating guy and just brilliant. And he's one of these brilliant minds and comedy geniuses that only come along once a millennium. So enjoy it. Check me out doing stand-up. I was in stand-up live in Phoenix, Arizona. I got to tell you, beginning of September, right after Labor Day, and we had a great time. Sold out shows. Check out the pictures online on my Facebook page and Twitter. And we can't thank everybody enough for coming out and just been kicking it on the road. And we're going to do that again come October 16th to the 19th. I'm at the Improv in Cleveland, Ohio, and October 29th to November 1st at Cap City Comedy Club in Austin, Texas. And November 6th through the 8th, I'm going to be at Comics at Foxwoods Comedy Club, and November 20th to the 23rd at the Omaha Funny Bone. So come see me in one of those venues. We were having a great time in Phoenix, and we're going to do more on the road. The Paul Mercurio Nation is building. Be part of it. Come out and see me. Follow me on Facebook and Twitter, and tell everybody about this podcast. I'm really proud of this to have Terry Gilliam on.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
Welcome to the show. It's an honor for me to have Terry Gilliam on my show, and I didn't think this would ever be happening to me, but I cannot tell you what a big fan I am, not just as a director, animator, actor of Monty Python, but an amazing filmmaker, Time Bandits, Brazil, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, and your new movie out, Zero Theorem. Welcome to the show. Thank you for doing this so much.
Hi. I'm sitting here in nice New York morning. The sun's beautiful. Yeah. I'm almost enjoying New York, the city I left long ago.
How did you live here for a while at one time?
Yeah, after college, I lived here for 3 years. It was 62 to 65. Mm-hmm. It was a bit of a different city, but it still, you know, it was a rhythm that ultimately wore me out, and I thought I had to escape, because surely there's a world somewhere outside of New York City.
Well, the 60s were tumultuous for you. I read that you said that you had to kind of get out of America because you would have probably been arrested for bombing the government or something to that effect. What was going on with you? I mean, obviously it was a tumultuous time in the world and in America, but how was it affecting you, and how was that manifesting itself?
Well, I mean, I had been a political science major in college, so, you know, I was already attuned to that side of events, and things were incredibly political at that time. I mean, the civil rights movement was going on, the Vietnam War was going on, feminism, gay rights, all of this stuff was, you know, alive out there, and the counterculture was there, which was looking at the world in a very different way, and I just became more and more disillusioned with America because, you know, you grew up believing in truth, justice, and the American way. You know, that
right.
We were the good in the world. That was America.
Mm.
And then you suddenly see this other side of it. And it was also at the time when, you know, Kennedy is assassinated, Martin Luther King is assassinated. You know, it was extraordinary. But it was also incredibly exciting because there was genuine change taking place, and people were genuinely involved in the political process, or either within the confines of a legislature or on the streets. And it was interesting. But I was just getting so disillusioned with the country, and I felt I had to leave because my anger had no healthy outlet. And I thought, okay, I'd done a lot of political cartoons, but that didn't seem to assuage my anger with the system.
Right. That doesn't.
For the safety of the country, I left.
Yeah. It wasn't enough to draw a cartoon and then punch the wall, huh? You really had to.
No, it didn't change that much of the world.
Well, did you consider channeling the anger into participating in being the agent of change? In other words, sort of, since you're a political science major and you obviously felt so passionately about it, sort of trying to work within or outside the system to kind of affect the kind of change that you thought was necessary?
No, I don't have the patience for that. It's as simple as that.
But you're a filmmaker who've made amazingly intricate films. You have the patience for that. I would think that you somehow have.
It's a way of reaching the people in a better way, possibly. Maybe a more effective way.
Oh, yeah.
If you can alter the way people think or perceive the world, they might be. They might have the patience to change it.
So you're how old at this time when you decide, I better. You grew up in Minnesota, a Midwest kid, and by the way, there's a thing called Minnesota Nice that I noticed. That when you're there, they're so nice to you, but there's an undercurrent of sort of passive aggressiveness too. It's a little.
It's an interesting place. I mean, it's very much affected by Scandinavians who pretend to be cool, are very hard at heart.
You everything's said with a smile on its face, but you kind of feel like, did that person just tell me to go fuck myself? And I'm not quite sure that they did, that kind of thing. Very.
But on the other hand, I mean, what I do remember from it is a real sense of community. That's the good side of it.
Yeah.
But then communities, if you're young, often become restrictive and claustrophobic, and any young person has got to try to escape his community.
Right. Well, it sounds like, like all of us, experiences in our youth or adolescence or, into our college years informs very much who we are and what we do. And the passions that you have come through in your films and, in Zero Theorem, I know sort of you're focusing on this sort of idea of we're in your view of the future and sort of that sort of machines sort of have hold on us. But expand on that for my listeners, because I think there's a through line in some of your work that sort of is fascinating to me in that regard.
Yeah, I suppose I suppose everything I do is sort of searching for individuality, trying to find out who the individual is, and it's such a strange time now because the individual seems to be merely connecting tissue between other people who think they might be individuals, and yet the whole thing becomes more and more like a beehive, an ant colony, a termite mound, where everybody has to be connected to as many people as possible all the time to actually know that they exist almost.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've said this. Never before has there been more technology that has allowed us to be closer, and yet it's getting in the way. Like, I literally had to yell at my son to pick up the phone when I call him to talk to me and not to communicate with me through text and Facebook. Like, it's baffling. I can't get my head around it.
But it's like it's easier and safer to communicate that way rather than direct communication.
Yeah,
direct
that's
communication. You've got to be able to speak. You've got to be able to argue. You've got to just not just say boom.
Right. You have to confront uncomfortable emotions and deal with them in a real way. Right. Exactly.
I mean, it is. I find it quite funny at times. I find it easier to talk on the phone than face to face with my wife. I don't know why. It is the distance, and so we grew up with the phone as the technology
yes.
Between us talking like we are now, but now the technology has moved it to another level. We don't even have to be articulate anymore.
Right.
We can just show a picture of the food we're eating or the person we're sitting
Exactly.
It's basically a very illiterate world that we're creating.
We've gone back to the caveman. We've gone back to the apes, right? We're sort of regressing.
Yeah. The other thing is that everybody now is the star of their own little universe.
Oh, yeah. So yep.
They appear on screens just like movie stars appear on screens.
Right. It's everybody's going to get that 15 minutes of fame, as Andy Warhol said. So in Zero Theorem, in the movie that's out now, it's a great movie, and Christoph Waltz is a star. Matt Damon, Tilda Swinton, an amazing cast. What are you trying to say with the movie? Because the thing that I love about your film work is there's always a message. There's always a Terry Gilliam message that's not just in the narrative, but in the beautiful way you shoot these movies. And what are you trying to say with this one?
Oh, there's probably a lot, as usual. This is why it would be an impossible film to pitch if you were trying to get it made by a studio.
Right. Because now, what do they do? They just go, Terry Gilliam, all right, just don't even bother with the pitch. Just give him the money. It's too hard to explain, and then you come back with this masterpiece.
That's the dream. They don't give me the money. That's the reality. Terry Gilliam, oh, no, those are confusing movies that only appeal to a small number of people. Don't forget about it.
Oh, God.
It's I don't know, it's like you start this movie, you know, I didn't write the script, but I embellished it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, basically, because it takes place almost 85% inside this one building, this burnt-out church, and it was full of ideas, the script was full of ideas, and there about what is the meaning of life, what does work mean, what are relations about. And I then surrounded it with a lot more comments about the world we live in, whether it be advertising that pursues us down the street, or the need for new religious beliefs, new churches, like the Church of Batman the Redeemer or the Church of Intelligent Design.
Mm-hmm.
We believe we are pro-lifestyle, Church of Intelligent Design. And so I built up a lot of stuff. I love advertising saying, you know, occupy Mall Street, shoppers of the world unite.
Nice.
That's this outside invasive world that our hero lives in, that he's trying to escape from. At the same time, I was trying to make the world a happy place, not a dark dystopian world, but a world where everybody's bustling around, they're colorful at work, you know, they're on their skateboards and rollerblades and zipping around, and nobody's thinking except our hero, who is the gray, the black hole of the piece. And I've also been for a long time obsessed by solitude, trying to encourage solitude in people so that they have time to consider who they really are rather than just constantly making noise to their peer group or whoever else. And so this is a chance to play with that. So and here's a guy waiting for a call that'll give him meaning to his life, which to me is kind of like every time you turn on the television, call this number, you know, and you will be fulfilled. Your life will be better. It's pretty much the way it works.
Right.
And then what's interesting is in his isolation, the world comes pushing its way back in the form of different characters.
Mm.
And he has to, in a sense, recover his humanity because there is no escape. And it is relationships. It's in many ways a very tragic film because he doesn't have the ability, whether he's damaged from past experience, which is limited his ability to commit or reveal himself. He can't go away with the girl. He even then tries to protect and becomes fatherly to a boy who that's taken away from him. We really sort of hammer this character, and in the end, what he chooses or where he ends up is kind of a dignified but rather sad ending where the virtual world is more comfortable than the real world. And I think that's what is happening with so many people, where they hide in the virtual world because it pretends to be like the real world without the complications and messiness.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that. I do TV appearances in this one show I go on regularly. is viewed every night. It's a nightly show. I go on, you know, every couple of weeks. And there's a woman on Twitter who watches every show and then grades the show on Twitter and grades the performances of the guests on the show. Now, the reason I tell this story is I was very fortunate to have Paul McCartney as a guest on my podcast, which I was very proud of and never thought would happen in my life, much like talking to you. You know, and it's a great thing about doing what I do is I'm getting to meet my heroes. And I was very proud of it and went on the show, long story short, and we talked about it for the first act of the show, which was about 8 minutes. And this woman wrote a nasty thing on Twitter, like, why would you spend so much time talking about Paul McCartney? Who cares? And she could not revel in my joy. She couldn't support that place, right? And I wrote back on Twitter, it's very sad that in the darkness of the safety and the solitude of your home, you can judge the world without ramifications and not revel in others' joy. You're a pathetic human being. And then she immediately got defensive and said, I really didn't mean it. And people came to her defense. And I said, well, now you know what it feels like when you put yourself out there and you get criticized. And I think it's a bad part of our culture. And I agree with you that we sort of live in this virtual world where we think that there are no ramifications to what we say and how we say it.
Correct. I mean, and the thing is that everybody now can be a critic.
Yes.
I mean, we all have our opinions about everything.
Right.
That's what we do.
Right.
But to be able to post it, to put it out there publicly, and not... But I did a podcast, a webcast, I mean, not a podcast, with Arcade Fire a couple of years ago, their show at Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And because there were all the producers, they were constantly monitoring to see how the show was being received, the tweets were coming in before the first song was even finished, halfway through the song. People were commenting, criticizing. They weren't in the moment at all.
Yeah.
They were there to say, it's all about what I think,
it's not about
what is going on.
Yeah, it's back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, about it's just about finding their own celebrity. And But what I think is interesting about you, and if I'm wrong, tell me, that you know, maybe we're alike in a lot of ways. I actually talk about this on my stand-up and my act. Like, I hate people on some level because they break my heart, because I want to think the best in them, and then they break my heart and they don't live up to my expectations. Are you sort of an eternal optimist, you think? Because your films have this sort of, this theme, in some of them at least, where you're slapping human beings and culture in the face and saying, can't you see what we're doing to ourselves? We can be better. And so you could look at your films as being negative, but I really think the undercurrent is that you're an eternal optimist and think that we can do better and should do better. Is that fair?
I think the eternal adjective, I'm not sure if it's correct anymore. the older I get, the more pessimistic I get. It's not even pessimism I get, the less I care, because there's always a momentum in life, in civilization and all.
Yeah.
And you think, you can scream and shout, but the juggernaut is still roaring towards the cliff. and I mean, one's job is to be a gadfly, I think, to try to make people think and consider what's going on around them. And again, maybe change their perception of the world. And then but little by little, you can slow the onslaught. But my pessimistic side is, you know, the onslaught will go on and on and until the whole thing drives over the edge of the cliff and crashes. And humanity is so good at rebuilding. It really likes rebuilding things. and yet, I'm not convinced we're very good at controlling where things go. They have their own momentum.
Yeah.
And everybody goes along with it, because there are far too many people who are just pragmatists, who work with whatever is happening at the moment rather than trying to halt or redirect it.
Right. That's so true. I mean, did you, when you were young and sort of you get out of America and you were doing animation, and which led to you sort of, you know, doing photographic strips for Help, and you met John Cleese, and that led to the Monty Python years. Were you sort of finding your way? Was animation clearly where you wanted to be, or you were just letting yourself be in the moment what you wanted to do? And then how did that build to you becoming part of the Monty Python experience?
Well, basically after university, college, I went to New York and worked with Harvey Kurtzman, the man who created Mad Comics, who was the hero of my generation of cartoonists, particularly. And he was brilliant, great satirist. That phone is ringing. That's destiny calling me. Maybe the meaning of my life is on the other end of the phone, but I'm not going to even attempt to lift it up.
Thank you.
Because we'll just carry on with this. So I was basically working in a magazine as a cartoonist. I was doing political cartoons and all of that. And then an animation was not what I wanted to be. I kind of dreamed of being a filmmaker, but having grown up just outside of Hollywood, when I was a teenager, there it was on the doorstep, but I just had no way of, I didn't really want to get into the system because I'm no good at working my way up through systems. I have to start normally at the top and work down.
You start at the top and work your way down? Is that what you said?
I have done this always in my life. It is absolutely true.
Why is that? What is that about? What does that say about you? What is that? Why? Because you're anti-authoritarian and you've got to eventually
It's probably that, or I'm just very lucky. And then the truth is out eventually, and I work my way down because I can't sustain being at the top. No, I mean, from college, Help Magazine was a magazine that Harvey Kurtzman was doing at that point after Mad. And I was, editing the College Humor magazine and was sending him copies. And I graduated without any idea of where to go, and I wrote him saying, I'm coming to New York. I'd really like to meet you. And he said, don't bother. There's nothing for people like you. And I said, anyway, I'm coming. And I arrived in New York, and I met him. And the guy who was assistant editor of the magazine was just quitting, and they needed a replacement. I walked into the job.
Jesus.
That's exactly what happened. And then, while working on Help, I met people like Cleese and all sorts of people because I was... Right there, I was the assistant editor.
What was Cleese doing with Help? Was he writing?
Well, what happened? We did these things called fumetti, which are just like comic strips, except they're photographs. Mm-hmm. They're staged photographs, and you tell a story just like you would with comics, and people speak with balloons. That's why they're called fumetti, because that's the Italian name for those little speech bubbles. And we would get actors to appear in these. I mean, I got Woody Allen to be in one of them. And John was over here with the Cambridge Footlights Review, which was in New York, really on the coattails of Beyond the Fringe, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore. And Cambridge Footlights included John, Graham Chapman, and several other very clever college comedians. And I got John to be in one of our fumettis. Again, it was a very prescient story because it was about a man who falls in love with his daughter's Barbie doll and has an illicit affair. and that really has been the pattern of John's life. These American Barbie doll wives he's had.
That's great.
So that's going on. Now the Vietnam War is hotting up. I had to go to basic training. Doing my bit for my country, and the magazine closed down. And I, as the assistant editor, wrote a letter to the National Guard saying that I was being transferred to our offices in Europe. and I went hitchhiking around Europe for almost 6 months. And I had a friend who is a writer who at that point now was living in Greece, on an island in Greece. And I then at that point started communicating with the army via this place in Greece, which was now the office of Help magazine in Europe.
Oh, my God.
And in the course of all this, I eventually ended up in, I'd come back to the States and worked in advertising for a bit, and then went to England and still doing magazine work, and illustrations, cartoons, everything like that. And John Cleese, by that point, had become very famous on television on the David Frost show. It was very popular. Mm-hmm. And so I recontacted John because we'd become quite friendly when we were here in New York, and said, I want to get out of magazines. Can you introduce me to somebody in television. And it ended up that I met the producer of a children's show that Mike Payne and Terry Jones and Eric Idle were writing and performing. And
Eric Idle and Palin were doing children's shows? That's a scary thing.
Yeah, well, the three of them were writing and directing. Because the great thing about children TV at that point, it was before the Muppets and all that, nobody paid attention to children's TV. Yeah. So it was a great ground to learn your comic craft doing children's shows.
Right.
And they were very funny shows. The Bonzo Dog Doodah Band was also on the show, which was a great band that Paul McCartney, in fact, the Beatles really supported. They're in the Magical Mystery Tour film.
Is that right?
Yeah. So anyway, I sold a couple sketches, and the producer then was doing another show called We Have Ways to Make You Laugh, which was after the children's show, and Eric Idle was on it, and I was on it as the resident cartoonist. They did caricatures of the guests. And one day they had this material they didn't know how to present, and I said, well, let me make an animated film with it. And they gave me a couple of weeks and a couple other pounds to do it. And the only way you could work at that speed for that kind of money was cutouts. And I started doing it. And I understood the principles of animation, and I've always been following, you know, Disney and then a lot of the really interesting cartoonists of the 60s, Stan Van de Beek and people like that. And so the principles were all there, and it went out on television, and suddenly overnight I became an animator.
doing cutouts, which was sort of the precursor to what we would see at the beginning of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And then because of that animation, I ended up doing stuff for Marty Feldman, and then I did some animations on the children's show again, some more of that, which then really brought Mike, Terry, Eric, and myself as together as a group. And then our group joined John Cleese and Graham Chapman, and we were Monty Python, and off we went.
I want to talk to you about TrueCar.com. TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,078 off manufactured suggested retail price. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com. And how did that sort of come together as Monty Python, and how did that name come about, just for the listeners who don't know?
John really had sort of an open invitation from the BBC to do a show, if he wanted to. And he was quite keen to work with Mike Palin, I think was the real connection. And then so the six of us got together and started writing and working on what we're going to do. And we spent a long time coming up with a name, because that's always the hard thing. What are you going to call the show? And
yeah.
I mean, we had very silly names, Horse, a Spoon in a Bucket, Owl Stretching Time. And eventually Python came up, because there was a thing called, Mike came up with Gwen Dibley's Flying Circus, and we liked the sound of Flying Circus, but Gwen Dibley didn't do it for us. And then along, we invented this name of what a really, really slimy artist agent in London, and his name was Monty Python. They just seemed nasty little character. So it was Monty Python's Flying Circus.
My son, this generation now, we're turning him on to Monty Python and to your films and to the Monty Python films, and he loves them. So your stuff is really timeless. And as a comedian, I know that's, and a writer myself, that's a very hard thing to do. And it's just brilliant. What was your creative process like in the group? Would you sort of write separately and then come together and share the ideas and sort of sift through them, and then you direct them and animate them? How would that work?
Yeah, it was pretty much that. It would, you know, we worked in different combinations. I mean, John and Graham Chapman worked together. Mike and Terry Jones worked together. Mm. Eric wrote on his own, and I did my stuff on my own. Mm. And yeah, ideas, sketches would all be written separately, and then we'd have our group sessions and sit down and start. It was very democratic. Oh, that one, put that in the definite pile. That one's in a not certain pile. That's rubbish pile. Hmm. And that's how everybody would read out the various things they had written. And then what would happen is like something Mike and Terry had written. They'd say, that's really good, but then it starts falling apart. And then John and Graham would take it over and rewrite it and move it into something else. And at a very early stage, because Terry Jones really loved the cartoons I'd been doing on the other shows, and they tended to be just stream of consciousness, humorous tales. And he said that would be a great way of making the show different, because there had been so many really wonderful shows that were sketch shows where the sketch would have to end on a punchline. And invariably the punchlines weren't as good as the sketch itself. Yeah. And so we cut out the punchlines, and basically the sketch would get to a certain point where it was still working, and then I would take over and become the connecting tissue to the next sketch. And that allowed me a lot of freedom and sufficient restrictions, and you know, I had to go from A to B.
Right, so in other words, that piece of animation that would be the connective tissue between what we just saw and what we're about to see would either have thematically, visually tie into what we just saw, or would feed us into the next piece in some way, or would it just be random, whatever you wanted to do?
No, it was what I wanted to do. They didn't really know, because I was, in those days, incredibly inarticulate in describing what it was I was trying to do.
You? Really? You're very articulate.
Oh, yeah.
You were able to convince the U.S. Army that you were running.
that wasn't humor. That was serious. You know, I really, to sit and try to describe what my cartoons were going to do and why and how they were going to work was really difficult. I mean, sometimes I'd have very clear stories that I wanted to tell between the sketches, so I could actually show those and explain those. But a lot, I couldn't. So I had the most freedom of anyone in the group in that sense, because I would take where they'd got to, and I would go with it. And nobody even knew what I was doing until the day of the recording of the show, when I'd turn up.
Really?
And the film, yeah. No, it was quite interesting. And the fact that it worked so well, it's kind of the magic of what happened there, because it just seemed to tie the stuff together and yet take things to a slightly different level.
But you would feel some compulsion, I would imagine, to have that piece of animation refer back to what we just saw or somehow relate to what we're about to see, right?
I mean, I was very responsible in that sense. Yeah. I wasn't trying to show off and take the limelight. No, it was... No, my job was to connect these things in an interesting and successful way. Now, I'm a very responsible person. Heart.
When you're not, it's right. But now, when you're directing these sketches, you start to know your actors. Obviously, you know their strengths. You know their weaknesses. Does it reach the point where at times it self-directs, or is everybody sort of directing and rewriting? Is it an ongoing process in the moment, or is the script locked and you're wedded to the script? Is there any improvisation around the script at all when you were shooting these?
Well, the thing is, I didn't direct anything until we did Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. I just did my bits.
Right.
And Ian McNaughton was the director. But the group, it was written. And in rehearsals, obviously, there would be a few things that would come out of rehearsals that would change it a bit, but there was very little ad-libbing going on with Python. It was basically a writer's show, and that's how it worked. And it was only my involvement. I was always slightly the odd man out. Not only was I the American, or as I was referred to by some, a monosyllabic Minnesota farm boy.
Passive aggressive too, I bet, just like those Minnesotans are.
They're bastards. Oh yeah. The British are the greatest passive aggressive people on the planet. And Queens can be incredibly intimidating when he chooses to be.
Yeah, I can imagine. But,
but what was always nice about the group, it really was six people who, you know, we were baffling the whole time, but everybody really respected each other's talent.
Right.
And we fed off each other. And it was at a certain point in the later shows, I was, you know, my animations were very much affected by what they were doing, and even their stuff became very much affected by the animations. So it was a constant cross-feeding, cross-breeding going on.
Now, how is your animation affected by what they're doing?
I would write what I thought was humorous dialogue. So I was working, you know, that way, putting more dialogue in, funny thing. It was just we were sparking off each other, and some of it would, you know, image that in one of the sketches that they did, I would find that's interesting, and then I would find a way of using or adapting that image into something that I was doing.
It's funny, you know, you talked about the democratic process, and Paul McCartney said the same thing about the Beatles. You know, at least early on, they get together. And, you know, Paul and John were doing most of the writing, but, you know, the other, George had stuff, and they throw it out there, and if it wasn't, the four of them couldn't put the, if you couldn't get four hands in the air, it went on either a dead pile or a maybe pile, and,
it was very funny, because George always said that, you know, because Python began when the Beatles, broke up, and he always thought the spirit of the Beatles flew directly into Monty Python.
Yeah. being an American add something to their comedy, to their writing, to the point of view of the show in some way beyond? I know you were, I don't want to underplay that you were just the animator, you were one of the troop members, but I'm curious how, I've always, like, as an American, did you bring something to that table that wouldn't have been there, and what was that in your mind?
Aggression.
So you were trying to.
I was really adamant that our job was to shock. Our job, shocking all people. Really.
Oh, really? You were the one that you wanted. Why they were a little concerned about sort of going too far at times.
Yeah, and I was always pushing it because I just felt. You've got to keep waking people up. You've got to say things that make them think, and not just entertain them all the time.
And how did they react to that? Was it hard to get them to go down that road with you?
No. I mean, we did it because Terry Jones was the closest to me in that sense. Him being Welsh, not English, and we really felt there was a conceptual. Approach to what we were doing sometimes, and it really was to push the barriers, see what happens, and that's all. I mean, because who knows where? But we know barriers are being put up all the time by others, ourselves, all. And to me, it was just keep knocking them down and see if we can still make people laugh and entertain them, but push things always.
Going back to your youth in the '60s, when you were, you know, a bit of a radical, obviously, and I think you always are and probably always will be. Were you feeling compelled at that time through the group to make political statements through the comedy and the sketches? And were you trying to do that? Was that met with resistance by the other group members? Any of that?
No, I think, I did that because I think the animations are more aggressive than the others. The others I shouldn't say that because the argument sketch is a very aggressive sketch, but it's like, but it was that. So I would do cartoons, you know, where a black spot, you know, a guy develops something on his face that irritates him, and it's a spot that eventually becomes cancerous, and the guy dies,
right.
And then the
right.
spot the spot is free. The spot is no longer tied down to this guy and his face, and it can go off and it meets another spot, and they fall in love with two black spots, and they breed like rabbits. So, and then the neighbors start complaining because all these blacks have moved in next door. So it was, you know, those are the kinds of ways I was doing it.
So,
and so you're saying quite strong political and social statements and getting away with it.
Yeah, where does this wild imagination come from? I know, you know, you brought up, your father was a salesman and your mom a homemaker.
Actually, my father was a carpenter and my mother was a virgin.
Nice.
And I knew that I was the Messiah. There was no question about it. They were very nice people, and they treated me like somebody very special in the family. They seemed to have been born with this whatever this genetic combo is that produces this kind of imagination. I never understood it. I don't explain it.
Even as a youth, even as a kid, were there sparks of this as a kid? Were you?
Yeah. No, I always had a great imagination, and. To be honest, I think my visual imagination came from listening to the radio all the time, because you have to invent the visuals. They're not there.
Yeah, it's not right there for you to... And then it's totally informed the look of your films over the years. How do you even start to kind of put some of those looks together in your head? Are you walking down the street and you see something, you go, you know, that would be a great motif for this next film? Or where does that spark and inspiration come from, or does it vary from film to film?
I think it always varies, but it's basically a magpie approach. You know, I see something glittering and I've got to pick it up and use it somehow.
Right.
And I love, you know, when I make a film, I love, and that's why... I think the only film I've done that is actually, you know, naturalistic, and you could say a contemporary film, is Fisher King. Everything else is an abstracted version of the world, whether it's, you know, medieval or futuristic.
Yeah.
Because to do realism is, I find, very hard. Now, I also don't like to do realism. I like to say this is artifice, what we're doing here.
Why is realism hard for you?
Because I think you've got to be really accurate, and you've got to be totally and utterly honest when you do it.
Yeah.
And I find by abstracting things to some degree, I can then play with it more. I can stretch things. It's just like, you know, I think it comes from being a political cartoonist, where you exaggerate things, and you can draw attention to the elements that you're interested in dealing with. And realism, and I also, it's partly my fear of how dangerous films are. And when you see a film, I remember years ago, Alan Parker made a very good film called Midnight Run, and it said it was the true story of Billy, whatever the guy's name was. Well, it turns out, and it just stuck with me. There was a Q&A after the screening, and Alan, you know, he's a really brilliant, smart, good filmmaker. He was so ingenuous up there talking about the fact, the ending isn't really the true ending, what happened in the story, but the true ending was to what's a Hollywood film and nobody would believe it.
Mm.
Well, wait a minute, you're saying this is the true story and yet you're not telling the truth,
right?
Exactly. That's dangerous. So the minute you can take that responsibility off me, I'm not trying to tell a total truth, I'm just trying to do my slightly abstracted, distorted version of what I think the world is at any moment.
Well, it seems, you know, in sort of getting to know you through this conversation, you've sort of, through your films, have blended your strong passion for commentary about the social condition and the political climate, along with your wildly fertile and inventive imagination, visually especially, and sort of tell the world what you want to tell the world through these sort of at times dystopian sort of worlds, or these futuristic worlds.
Yeah, I think,
you know,
I always used to say that my films are always messages in the bottle. I'm actually, and I used to be living in England, I kept so many of them are messages in the bottle, I was sending back to America. And it's that's really it. I suppose I've got this very moral, strong moral sense, whatever that might be. And I'm not I'm not a fundamentalist in any way about anything, but I do feel there is a responsibility when you make movies, because they're such powerful things.
There's a responsibility to have a point of view and a message to try to make a change. What is that responsibility for you?
Some of that, no, the main responsibility, I think, is to be honest.
Yeah.
However, you know, weird that honesty may be, and I find so many films are just not honest. They're fantasy films, and they're designed to reassure you that the world is okay, so that you feel good, and we'll go and watch some more movies. So it's that bothers me, and I just want to encourage people to be, I think, intelligent, to think, to reconsider.
Well, you know, I worked on The Daily Show as a writer, and the people say, "Oh, well, for a while I worked there and in that capacity." And people say, "Oh, you know, we only get our news from The Daily Show." I'm like, "No, you should go read. You should read, and you should not just read opinions that are going to reinforce your opinions. Read people. If you're on the right, read people who write about the left from a left perspective, and vice." The problem is that nobody's truly open to dialogue anymore. It's an artifice. You know, these cable news shows are just mouthpieces for the left, right, and nobody's truly having a dialogue in the sense of, okay, I'm not agreeing, Terry, with you 100% on this issue, but I'll listen to you, and you listen to me, and maybe you'll change my mind, or maybe you'll have a point. It's everybody just wants reaffirmation of what they already believe.
Well, I remember years ago, every time I come to New York, the States, I turn on Fox News.
Yeah.
Because I just want to know what most people are watching when it comes to news and how they're being affected. And I was watching, and it was Bill O'Reilly was on. And, you know, and he's a very smart guy.
Yeah.
He's a very clever guy, articulate, and all that. And I was in the bathroom shaving, and then I heard this voice. It was like some rusty razor that was scraping, and it was shrill. It was painful. And even though I had never heard this voice before, I had, because I'd been reading a lot, I had heard about the name that must go with a voice like that. And the name was Ann Coulter.
Ah.
And the two of them are having this heated discussion, and they're pretending to say this is a balanced political discussion.
Yeah.
You've got one guy on the far right, and you've got a woman on the extreme right. This is madness.
And that
is the nonsense that people are living with day in and day out in this country.
Yeah. So where do you see, you know, just to kind of wrap this up with you, where do you see the world right now, and how do you feel about the world and America, you know, from where you sit these days?
I don't know. I don't know. I think I'm less confident about anything these days. I think America is clearly the empire has reached its peak and is now descending ever so slowly and slightly. And I often fear about empires that are on the decline, especially when they're as heavily armed as this one is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And do you feel, I mean, with this such a different world than the 60s in terms of the terrorism around the world and all of that, I mean, does that influence you as a filmmaker? Do you want to talk about that? Is it sort of an...
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, there was much more terrorism back then than there is now.
In what way? In what sense? How so?
Oh, I mean, in the 70s, 80s, I mean, planes were being hijacked left, right, and center. The IRA was bombing London. Ships were being hijacked. There was a lot going on that was more immediate than actually was a direct threat. Okay, 9/11. I'm sitting here looking at the new, whatever it's called, Freedom Tower, or whatever it is outside my window.
Right.
And, I mean, that was a horrific event. But it was more about quantity and the shock that America, something had actually happened on American soil. I think at the moment when I'm reading about ISIS, or as we say, ISIS is now, and the threat, and they're going on, I get here and the radio's on, and I say, what is going on? It sounds like they're at the shores of New Jersey. They're ready to come in, and the idea that they are encouraging Americans to kill other Americans. I said, what's wrong with this country? We don't need ISIS to get us to do that. We do that really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, high school kids are really good at killing other Americans. And so why do we need these terrorists? But it's about the direct threat. That's what's important. And, you know, America's been lied to so much, you know, the weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And so there's a cynicism that's taking over, I think, in the country. And also, I think there's a sense of impotence, because what can you do to change it? I think people are becoming apolitical, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you figured out a way to make change through art and through film, as opposed to trying to work within the system, and that works for you and probably has reached many more people than going that other route. I don't know if we're more cynical than we were. I think we've always been a fairly cynical country and a fairly cynical society. I think we're maybe less innocent than we were in the 40s and the 50s. Maybe the 60s was when sort of, the bloom was off the rose, so to speak. But I feel I was just on a panel, actually on one of the cable shows, and we were talking about, like, why would 300 Americans want to be so disenfranchised and join up with ISIS? And it's like, you know, when you're sitting in an ivory tower, it's easy to ask that question, but there are a lot of miserable people out there whose lives aren't that good.
Have you watched the Vice documentary?
No, I have not.
It's a documentary, this group Vice, their magazine, and they had a documentary about ISIS, and they're there. And in England, everywhere, it's been, this is getting oxygen to terrorists. Mm. And what you see when you watch it is people who don't have much. Their life has no meaning as such. They're scrambling around. They're not important to anybody. And suddenly you see they've got a cause to fight for. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in their cause. I think it's completely wrong. But I can understand it. I remember when I was, doing basic training in the Army, the Vietnam War was going on, and who were signing up? I was doing it under duress.
Right.
I didn't want to be in there. But all these young guys were turning up, Latino, black kids, who had very little in their life. But the idea of being given a uniform and
yes.
a gun and a cause
yes.
to fight for is what it was about.
Yeah, absolutely. I also say that power in the people's hands who've never had it is one of the most dangerous things. I mean, I see it with low-level comedy club owners who were, pushing a broom at one time, and they put together a couple of bucks and got a comedy club, and then boom, they start acting like complete assholes. It's a bad situation when someone doesn't have something to grab onto, and when they do, if it's not the right thing, it's very destructive. By the way, I cannot possibly see you in basic training. You're such a rebel. How did you not get thrown out? Like, how did you even last the day? Did you, like, were you not giving everybody the bird left, right, and center? Like, how did you do that? What was like what was it like for you to be in basic training? And what were you?
I hated it, but it used to be when we would, be out there with we'd have our rifles, and we'd have to do these little exercises, charging up the hill, firing, and the rifles, of course, only had blanks in them, so they don't make the sound of a real gun.
Right.
And as I was running up the hill, I was like. and the drill sergeants were just going crazy. What are you doing, Gilliam? I said, I'm trying to make it sound like a real war. Come on, give me a break here.
you were directing.
And they all thought I was crazy.
you were directing the war. That's beautiful.
Yeah, if we're gonna go and kill, it's gotta have the right sound effect.
Right, exactly. Suddenly, you start pulling out fake blood, and
I wondered if I could have. I actually got through it by my commanding officer, who was several years younger than me, which is a very difficult thing to salute this stupid little lieutenant who loved being a martinet and strutting around the place. But he discovered I was a cartoonist, and once they see somebody with a little bit of talent, the Army loves using it, so I ended up on the Post newspaper, and I would just spent so long doing my little cartoons, avoiding any of the proper military stuff that I should have been doing, and that's how I survived it, basically.
Oh, God. I got to ask you one more question. In the Holy Grail, our hero is in the woods, and he meets up with the another knight or whatever, and there's the fight, and he keeps fighting, and the limbs get knocked off, and then he's just a stump, and he just continues to fight, right? How did that, you know, special effects weren't what they are now. How did you pull that off? How did that happen?
Well, it was not too difficult. I mean, at the beginning, it was John Cleese himself as the Black Knight.
Right.
And then as limbs started coming off, we got this guy who was actually a silversmith who was one-legged. So the arms we could chop off because we could tuck his real arms behind his back and put false arms on.
Right.
And then a leg came off. That was fine.
Right.
And ultimately, when he's just a torso, we dug a hole in the ground and stuck the remaining leg in the hole.
So that guy jumping around was a blacksmith with one leg that you found, and you just put him in that?
Correct.
Oh, my
Correct.
God. Oh, that's, oh, my God.
And it's so funny. This is the thing. Without CG, there's such a weird, wonderful believability in this stuff.
Yeah.
It sticks with you. CG is now, it's taken over any kind of reality anymore. And gravity has almost been, you know, removed from the equation. I really don't like it.
Are you under a lot of pressure now as a filmmaker to use CG when you can to save money and budgetary?
Yeah, I mean, I do it. I mean, Zero Theorem, we've got about, I know there's 260 effect shots, and they're all CG because it's cheaper than using maquettes or even one-legged goldsmiths.
Yeah, but you know you can't catapult a cow out of a castle onto somebody other than the way you did it, man. That every time you see that,
do you know how we did it?
How did you do that? Was it my other? I hope you don't mind these questions. I'm sure you get asked this a million times, but
nobody asked about the cow.
Like, you see that cow, and every goddamn time you laugh your ass off. It never fails. It's awesome.
But what it is, I got the guys, you know, we had to dig a hole in the ground. We dig a lot of holes before we had CG, basically. And so all of the guys in the foreground as knights are all kneeling down in this hole so that their heads and helmets are below the parapet of the castle.
Right.
And then I would then just, you know, make a mat for the castle, the parapet, and replace the sky. And the sky and the animals coming over were shot in a friend's back garden, and the animals were toy animals from, you know, miniature farm set. We just threw in the air.
Seriously?
Yeah, that's what you see flying over the battlements. They're just little toys, and they're a few inches long. They're just thrown over, and then when it actually lands on the squire, it's just this terrible stuffed cow that we lowered rapidly off a crane.
And then I get asked in The Meaning of Life, how do you get him to explode when he's so fat? How did that come
about? Again, absolutely, it's actually a real thing. We built it. We built this huge body with all the guts and everything in it.
You did?
And then rigged it. Terry, it's all, you know, this big mechanical body and a lot of prosthetics around his face.
Oh, my God, it's so brilliant. Well, the thing that you've been able to do for years is dark comedy and make it work, you know, like a man getting his arms and his legs cut off and you're laughing hysterically at the end of it, a cow getting tossed, which is the most one of the, you know, beautiful passive animals, and it's just getting tossed like recklessly, and you're laughing, and it's as a comedian, it's so hard to do. You guys are genius at it. And
were you on the Stewart Show years ago when I was outside begging?
I was there. I don't. What were you doing outside begging? I don't remember that.
This is when I did Tideland. The distribution company was doing nothing. It was opening on the weekend, and my daughter says, "Come on, you've got to do something." And I took the poster and mounted it on some old shitty cardboard, and scrawled on the cardboard, you know, "Studio left film director, family to support, will direct for food." And we drove the limousine, because the one thing, they had no money for promotion, but they put me in a very nice big car and drove me around town for the interviews. And so we drove over to the Stewart Show, because everybody said there's a big queue outside. We parked around the corner. I started up from the back of the queue. my daughter was at the head of the queue with a video camera recording it, and I'm going along with this sign and a plastic cup with some coins jiggling, saying, independent filmmaker, but we're dependent on your goodwill, sir. Could you give a dime? And people, it's great to watch because people are turning away. A bum is on the street. And the security guys are trying to get me off the pavement. And I said, this is a public space, sir. You know, this, I have my rights too. And little by little, people started recognizing me. Uh-huh. And we ended up with a good crowd of people photographing. And I'm just saying, please come to the cinema this weekend, because if we don't do well this weekend, it'll be gone.
Oh, wow.
And they came, and it managed to keep the film on.
Really?
For about 5 weeks.
Oh, good. Yeah. But they didn't initially know that it was you? That's hilarious.
No, they didn't. I mean, a lot of people didn't. They just saw this guy looking embarrassing.
And they do. They'll look the other way. That's what they do in New York now. It's just like, I don't want
to
deal with it.
But that was what was interesting to watch.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it. And we put it on film. And the best thing is that having finished and met and talked to a bunch of people, we got back in the car, and my daughter kept the camera running, and I'm counting the money I made. It was $25. We stuck it on YouTube with the Pink Floyd song Money over the background, and it really went around quite a bit, and it's the only way the film had any hope.
Oh, that's great. That's a great story. Yeah, well, it's great. You know, you got to keep making them, because there's nobody doing what you're doing. You're such a unique voice. I can't, you know, it's just amazing what you do. And you know, it's are you coming to New York a lot these days, or what?
No. Actually, that's one of the things about renouncing my U.S. citizenship. I've got a year and a half of probation left. I'm only allowed in the country 30 days a year.
Oh, wow. Why did you renounce your citizenship?
Because George W. Bush got reelected, and I said, what is wrong with this country?
Wow.
I mean, especially when the people that voted for him are the ones that suffer the most. I mean, what is wrong?
Yeah.
And I renounced it, but they then keep you on probation for 10 years, and I'll be able to come back to the country for longer periods.
Wow. Well, I got to tell you, it's you got to come back. You got to keep coming back, and it's just been great to have you on. It's been terrific. So, thanks. People need to go out and see your movie, because you need to keep making movies, because we need you to make movies. It's The Zero Theorem, and it's out now in theaters and also on demand. And this has been Terry Gilliam, and I cannot tell you what a treat and an honor it has been to have you on my show. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great.
All right, so that was the great, genius, brilliant, provocative Terry Gilliam. I don't use those words lightly. I could talk to that man all day, and I swear to God I'm going to talk to him some more. And the idea of him being in the Army just blows me away. I don't see that working at all. It was an honor to have him on. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, we had great shows in Phoenix, Arizona. Thanks for everybody coming out. Check out the pictures on Facebook and Twitter. And coming up, my tour dates. I'm in New York City the rest of September, and then I'm in the Cleveland Improv in Cleveland, Ohio, October 16th to the 19th. Cap City Comedy Club in Austin, Texas, October 29th to November 1st. November 6th through the 8th, I'm at Comics Comedy Club at Foxwoods in Connecticut. And November 20th to the 23rd at the Omaha Funny Bone. So if you're in that any of those areas and those cities, come and check me out. I'll be mad if you don't. And keep spreading the word about the podcast, everybody. Send the link around and follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you, people.
We take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf.
Because it's all.